Thankful to be with you this morning. We have just a number of visitors with us, and we're grateful for your presence. This morning, I appreciate the thoughtful way that Andrew led us in singing those songs and looking at Proverbs 3. In truth, he may have done a better job with it than I will, but we're going to press on anyway. The first nine chapters of the book of Proverbs are a continuous exhortation, and one of the major themes in those chapters is a plea to get wisdom. It comes up over and over and over again. It happens in a couple of ways. It happens in the form of exhortations that we'll look at in just a moment. It also happens in the form of wisdom being presented as a beautiful woman who is good and just and right and lovely and therefore should be pursued. Sometimes she is set over and against the immoral woman or the woman of folly as a contrast. But there is this constant pleading to seek wisdom. Just a few sample statements, and it really are a few. This isn't even a third of the exhortations of this type. In Proverbs 1:5, a wise man will hear an increase in learning, and a man of understanding will acquire wise counsel. In Proverbs chapter 2 and verse 2, make your ear attentive to wisdom. Incline your heart to understanding. Proverbs 3:13 that we just looked at a moment ago, how blessed is the man who finds wisdom and the man who gains understanding. Proverbs 4:7, the beginning of wisdom is acquire wisdom. And with all you're acquiring, get understanding. Proverbs 7 and verse 4, say to wisdom, you are my sister, and call understanding your intimate friend. In Proverbs 8 and verse 10, take my instruction and not silver, and knowledge rather than choicest gold. And so you begin to get a sense of how pervasive this theme is in the first part of Proverbs. And of course, we talked about this in the context of parenting not too long ago. You begin to wonder why he keeps saying this over and over and over and over again. And the answer really is obvious, and that is a shocking number of people are going through life under the illusion that they know what in the world they're doing. And they don't. Look around. Just a few moments of observation would make it evident that the vast majority of people don't have any idea what life is about. And not only do they not have any idea, not only could they not articulate the purpose or meaning of life, but they are making tragic mistakes that have lasting and eternal consequences. They have made their life a misery, and they are not even aware of how it happened. And so the proverb writer pleads with people, get wisdom, get understanding. Now, the plea is somewhat focused. Many of these exhortations are a father speaking to a son. And one of the points that's made is that the naive are especially vulnerable. In Proverbs chapter 9, there are a couple of women, again, wisdom and folly. And the lady folly the woman folly in the latter part of this description in chapter 9 says, whoever is naive, in Proverbs 9:16, let him turn in here. And to him who lacks understanding, she says, stolen water is sweet and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. But he does not know that the dead are there, that her guests are in the depths of Sheol. And so the naive are described as those who see only the immediate, tangible benefits of what's on offer. The quick payoff. They believe in the shortcut. They believe that there's such a thing as a free lunch. And they are dangerously unaware of the consequences, the lasting consequences of their actions. They only see the quick payout. And so they're vulnerable. And they're vulnerable to this kind of appeal because they don't have the wisdom or the experience, and they lack the inability or inclination to discern between the claims of wisdom and folly. The proverb writer says in Proverbs 14:15, the naive believes everything. They are credulous. But the sensible man considers his steps. A wise man is cautious and turns away from evil. But a fool is arrogant and careless. And let me describe this arrogance. It is the arrogance that says, oh, well, that'll never happen to me. I know that some others have fallen into those kinds of pitfalls, but that will never happen to me. I'm not subject to that kind of problem. That is folly. That is foolishness. But the naive don't recognize that. They don't realize that. And of course, there is a certain amount of naivete that goes with youth. It's not necessarily culpable. They're not responsible for it. They just haven't had all of those experiences. But one of the things that gets driven home the longer you live is that at every new place in life, you come upon things and think, I've never been here before and I don't know what I'm doing. That is not an experience unique to youth. It continues to happen throughout your life. I've mentioned the statement that my father-in-law has made. I heard him make it three or four times just a couple of weeks ago when I was traveling with him. He was talking to other people, and he kept saying, he's going to be 87 years old in a couple of weeks. And he kept saying, I keep looking around for an older preacher to talk to, and I can't find one. And that's right. But he's facing new things. Right now, at this moment, he is facing new challenges, new things, things he's never done before, things he's never had to cope with before. And he'd like some help. And so that doesn't, it's not, you don't sort of age out of that sort of feeling of, I don't know what I'm doing. I wish that were true. It'd be nice if you got to the ripe old age of, say, I don't know, 11 or 12, and finally you knew everything and knew how to handle everything. That'd be fantastic. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way at 11 or 12, or 21 or 22, or 51 or 52, or 81 or 82. We continue to face things that we are not equipped to deal with and don't have the experience to deal with. The danger is when, like the naive, as they're described here, we don't recognize that. And so we need to recognize, you know what? I don't know what I'm doing. Now, if the naive are vulnerable, the proud are doomed. It's those who are absolutely certain that they are right, that they know, and that they have nothing to learn. The proud and the naive are often lumped together. We saw that in Proverbs 14, 15, and 16. In Proverbs 9 and verse 8, the proverb writer says, "Do not reprove a scoffer, or he will hate you. Reprove a wise man, and he will love you." And in Proverbs 13, 1, a wise son accepts his father's discipline, but a scoffer does not listen to rebuke. And so again, when somebody comes along and says, you know, I think you're going in a direction that's maybe not good, how do we respond to that? Do we immediately get angry? How dare you tell me? Or do we pause and think, well, maybe I need to give this some consideration. Maybe I need to give this some thought. Because the scoffer is the man who always knows better. And no one can tell him anything. And in consequence, he scoffs at wisdom and instruction. And after a while, that kind of behavior becomes evident to other people. And they begin to pull back. They begin to move away from you. Because also, as the proverb writer says, it is better to meet a bear robbed of her cubs than a fool in his folly. And again, that's, you know, you can learn that in traffic. But those are the barriers. That's what keeps people from getting wisdom. Thinking they know. Thinking they've got this sorted. Thinking they've got it handled. And so when we think about getting wisdom, we need to think about how we do that and where it comes from and the attitude necessary to acquire wisdom. We saw again in Proverbs 4:7 and all those other passages that we led off with that the beginning of wisdom is acquire wisdom. That the wise man knows he doesn't know and he is seeking after it. Proverbs 30, beginning in verse 2, I think is one of the greatest examples of this. As we look at the words of Agur, he says, "Surely I am more stupid than any man, and I do not have the understanding of a man. Neither have I learned wisdom, nor do I have the knowledge of the Holy One." Now understand that this is Agur's resume as a wise man. And what he is saying is, let me prove to you how wise I really am. I am so wise that I know that I don't know. And that's an exemplary resume when it comes to wisdom. Because that's the only foundation from which someone can become truly wise, is to know that they don't know. And he says, look, I don't have the knowledge of the Holy One. He doesn't mean he doesn't know anything about God. What he means is, I don't know what God knows. And I don't even pretend to begin to know what God knows. And he begins to ask a series of questions that are very much like the questions that God asked Job at the end of that book. He says, who has ascended into heaven and descended? Who has gathered the wind in his fists? Who has wrapped the waters in his garment? Who has established all the ends of the earth? What is his name or his son's name? Surely you know. And of course, the point of all those questions, nobody knows the answer to those questions except God. Every word of God is tested, that is tried, found reliable. He is a shield to those who take refuge in Him. And so the whole foundation of Agur's wisdom is, I don't know, but God knows. And the beginning of wisdom is knowing you don't know, and the end of wisdom is knowing that God knows. And so that's where I've got to go, because I don't have any idea how any of this stuff works. Again, Job came to the very same conclusion. There's an interesting sort of dichotomy to the way wisdom is presented in the book of Proverbs, and particularly the early part of the book of Proverbs, because on the one hand, wisdom is readily available. You look at Proverbs chapter 2, or chapter 1, verses 20 through 23. And wisdom here, again, is personified as a woman. It says, wisdom shouts in the street. She lifts her voice in the square. At the head of the noisy streets, she cries out. At the entrance of the gates in the city, she utters her sayings. How long, O naive ones, will you love being simple-minded? And scoffers delight themselves in scoffing, and fools hate knowledge. Turn to my reproof. Behold, I will pour out my spirit on you. I will make my words known to you. And so we see wisdom, and she's crying out in the street. She's, yeah, hey, come here. I've got something, and I'll give it to you. All you've got to do is come and get it. It's yours. It's freely available. Why won't you listen? And so on the one hand, wisdom is readily available to anybody who wants it. But then there's another side to this, another aspect to this. In Proverbs 2, 4, and 5, father says to his son, if you seek her as silver and search for her as for hidden treasures, then you will discern the fear of the Lord and discover the knowledge of God. And so he's telling you, you're going to have to look. You're going to have to work hard. It's not going to fall into your lap. And as you read this, you're sort of reminded of Job chapter 28 and verses 12 and following, where Job says something very similar about the accessibility of wisdom. He says, where can wisdom be found, and where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its value, nor is it found in the land of the living. The deep says, it is not in me. And the sea says, it is not with me. Pure gold cannot be given in exchange for it, nor can silver be weighed as its price. It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir, in precious onyx or sapphire. Gold or glass cannot equal it, nor can it be exchanged for articles of fine gold. Coral and crystal are not to be mentioned. And the acquisition of wisdom is above that of pearls. The topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. Where then does wisdom come from, and where is the place of understanding? Thus it is hidden from the eyes of all the living and concealed from the birds of the sky. Abaddon and death say, with our ears we have heard a report of it. And then he goes on to say, God understands its way. It's with God. You can't, it's hard to find. It's hard to come by. And so, which is it? Is it crying out in the streets? Is it readily available to everybody? Or is it nearly impossible to find? Well, yeah, that pretty much describes the situation. It is readily available in that God gives wisdom freely to those who want it. But the thing about getting wisdom is you can't want it a little bit. You can't just sort of say, well, you know, it'd be nice to be wise. That'd be kind of a cool thing to have, like a, you know, I don't know, a new tie or a belt or something that would sort of accessorize your wardrobe if you're interested in that sort of thing. It's not like that. The only people that find wisdom are the people that are willing to give up everything else in the getting of it. Yes, it's readily available. Yes, God gives it freely. But you can't want it a little bit. It can't be a hobby. You've got to give yourself to it. At every moment, in every situation, you've got to think, I don't know what I'm doing, and I need God's wisdom. I need God's instruction. And people like that are going to pore over what God has said. I would submit to you, and this is a little strange, I think. I kind of get why Christians don't read Leviticus that much. I mean, I don't agree with it, but I get it. All right, all the sacrifices and the regulations, and I understand. Again, I don't agree with it, but I understand it. But then, right in the middle of our Bibles is this whole book about how to live life without making a total mess of things. And it doesn't get that much press. And I don't understand. Because it's not as if it's not really relevant to our situation. I think Leviticus is relevant to our situation, but that's another sermon. That's not this sermon. But Proverbs talks about work, neighbors, marriage, sex, money, and most people seem to be marginally interested in one of those two things. But we ignore it? That doesn't make any sense. It's right there. It's been laid in our laps. And we need to look for it. And we need to know it comes only from God. Now, with that caveat, it comes only from God, those with more experience may be able to help us. Think about Proverbs 4, 1 through 5. There are three generations set forth in this passage. And what we see is wisdom being handed down from one generation to the next and then the next. And so Solomon is speaking here and he says, "Hear, O sons, the instruction of a father, and give attention that you may gain understanding. For I give you sound teaching. Do not abandon my instruction. When I was a son to my father, tender and the only son in the sight of my mother, then he taught me and said to me." And so David taught Solomon, who teaches his sons. Now we may look at Solomon's sons and say it didn't take too well. And maybe that's so. Perhaps not in every case. But it was handed down from one generation to the next based on humility before God, but also based on the Word of God being, as Agur said, the Word of God is tested, it is tried. They did these things and they found God to be faithful and they found God's ways to be good and just and right. And so he says, "My father taught me this, and I'm teaching it to you. I'm handing it down. Let your heart hold fast my words. Keep my commandments and live. Acquire wisdom. Acquire understanding. Do not forget nor turn away from the words of my mouth." And so it's not just age. But when age and wisdom come together, there's an opportunity there. And we should seek out those who have been through what we're going through. And we should talk to them. Now, a lot of times people do that very thing. They seek out people who have been through what we're going through. But sometimes when we do that, we look for all the wrong things. What we do is we go looking for sympathy. And so I was reading something some time ago where a guy, and as I'm reading this, I'm thinking, okay, why do you need to say this? But he's addressing a situation where somebody's business has failed. And he says, "Please, if your business failed, don't find a bunch of other people with failed businesses. They'll be sympathetic, but they may not be the best people to help you. What you need to find is somebody who succeeded. Somebody who did it right. But so often, that's exactly what we do. We go looking for sympathy. We go looking for somebody else who's been through what we're going through. But that's not really what we want to find. It's not sympathy, but wisdom. The proverb writer says in Proverbs 13:20, he who walks with wise men will be wise, but the companion of fools will suffer harm. And so, whether it's your business or your marriage, or whatever you're dealing with, maybe find somebody who's applied godly wisdom to that situation and enjoyed the fruits of that godly wisdom. Don't find somebody who tried it their own way and failed epically and can come along and say, "Oh man, I know how you feel. I blew it too." I mean, that, I guess you get the sympathy, but I'm not really sure how much help it's going to be. And if what we want is wisdom, then we need to go to the people who have the wisdom. Now, maybe they failed and then succeeded. That's good, because they probably got more wisdom. But if all they've done is fail, maybe you need to grab them and take them with you when you find the guy who hasn't, instead of just glorying in the sympathy of a shared experience. Again, he who walks with wise men will be wise. And so there's a lot to be said. Maybe you think, "Well, I'm not wise." Okay, well, surround yourself with people who are. Cultivate friendships with people who are older and have more experience. Don't just go to your peers all the time, because they probably got all the same questions you do. Find somebody older. Again, that gets harder as time goes by. But work at it, because it's worth it. Older and godly. And finally, do not reject discipline. Sometimes we encounter situations that have great potential to teach us wisdom. Sometimes in some not so pleasant ways, but nonetheless, there's an opportunity here. In Proverbs 3:11 and 12, the proverb writer says, "My son, do not reject the discipline of the Lord or loathe his reproof. For whom the Lord loves, he reproves, even as a father corrects his son in whom he delights." Now, there are at least a couple of ways that this, maybe a couple of broad categories that cover how this happens. Sometimes we suffer the consequences of our own actions. Sometimes we do things that are not wise, and we suffer the consequences of that, and now we have a choice. There's an opportunity to learn. Proverb writer says in Proverbs 12:1, "Whoever loves discipline loves knowledge, but he who hates reproof is stupid." Now, I think the B part of that verse is not difficult to interpret. Yeah, it's not smart to hate correction. But God has sort of wired correction in to foolishness. When we do foolish things, there are bad consequences attached to those things. God set the universe up that way because he loves us, by the way. He attaches consequence to bad choices because he wants us to learn, and there's an opportunity. You don't have to keep doing the same thing. You don't have to beat your head against the wall and ask why you have a headache. A lot of people do that. But if you keep doing the same thing and expect a different result, well, they call that insanity in some books. Maybe that may not be the official DSM kind of definition of insanity, but it's a good working definition of insanity. He who neglects discipline despises himself, but he who listens to reproof acquires understanding. Proverbs 15:22. And so we all learn from our mistakes. Again, I've talked about my dad's thing. He said all the time, experience is a cruel teacher, but fools will learn by no other. And I finally figured out he's talking about me. But better to be a fool who learned than a fool who didn't. And if we have, it's always better to learn by somebody else's experience. But if we have to learn by our own experience, at least learn. Don't reject the discipline of the Lord. Now, sometimes discipline's not punitive. In fact, in the situation where this passage is quoted in the New Testament, in Hebrews chapter 12, 5 and following, it's not punitive. God allowed this group of Christians to undergo persecution. He permitted that to happen to them so that they would learn to trust in Him and so that they would learn to value the spiritual over the physical. There are all kinds of reasons that we could tease out from the text. He says in Hebrews 12, 7 and 8, it is for discipline that you endure. It is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as sons. For what son is there whom a father does not discipline? But if you are without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. And so he says, look, the fact that you're suffering, the fact that you're going through all this difficulty and all these challenges just shows that God really loves you, He's really working on you, and He wants you to become more faithful, more hopeful, more devoted, more spiritually minded. And so He's working on you, and He's allowed these things to happen so that you can grow. Paul in 2 Corinthians 12, 7, as he talks about the thorn in the flesh. Paul's thorn in the flesh was to keep him, Paul says, because of all these revelations he's received, all these wonderful things that he had heard, he says, God gave that to him to keep him from exalting himself. Now, it happened. Satan was involved in that as well. Satan was trying to destroy him. But again, God allowed that to happen to Paul to keep him from exalting himself. And to teach Paul that God's grace was more than sufficient. Now, God was not punishing Paul. God was not angry at Paul for a wrong done. What he was doing is he's preparing Paul for a greater good. He's making a good man great. He's making a spiritual man more spiritual. He's making a faithful man more faithful. He's making a humble man more humble. It's not punitive. God wasn't angry. Paul is not suffering because of some wrong that he had done. And he learns and he benefits from this because he's humble and receptive. And whatever hardship, whatever difficulty, and whatever blessing as well, comes our way, there's an opportunity to learn. We tend to learn better from our hardships than we do from our blessings, which is why God uses them. They tend to be a lot more instructional. And it's just the way it is. If you reach out and touch something that's really, really hot and you get burned, you're probably not going to do that again. I think Jacob broke his habit of grabbing lawnmower mufflers after one experience that left an indelible mark on him. He thought, that's a bad idea. And I suspect that's, even though it happened to him when he was like two, I suspect it stuck with him. You haven't grabbed any lawnmower mufflers. No, he doesn't do that anymore. And so a lot of times suffering does indelibly mark on us. But we need to learn. We need to ask the question, what's the lesson in this? What do I need to learn from this? What do I need to take away from this? And if we'll do that, we'll be blessed. Again, this is not the end, just more by way of introduction than anything else. I hope to think further with you about the wisdom literature this year and consider more of these themes. If God wills, next month, we're going to talk about another theme that sort of applies some of these principles that runs all through the first 9 chapters, again, of Proverbs. And that is the folly of immorality. And so, I'm not going to give any more preview than that for now. But this is ongoing. But for this morning, the lesson is simply this. That the foundation for acquiring wisdom is humility and reverence. We have to know that we don't know and that God does know. And when we operate from that basic platform all the time, everywhere and in every circumstance, when we think like Agur did. And I'm not a fan of tattoos, but if I was going to get one, it would be Proverbs 30 and verse 2 right here. So I saw it every morning. Surely I'm more stupid than any man. Because that's a reality that I need to live with. Every time I get in trouble, it's because I think I know. And I don't. God does. So what I need to do is I need to acquire His wisdom because I don't have any of my own. And I think, based on observation, I think that I'm not completely alone in that. So I commend this to your ongoing meditation and thought. Now, if you're not a Christian, what that means is that you have made a decision that you are, in fact, the most capable person as concerns running your life. You're going to do a better job of that than anybody else. And so that's the way you've progressed up to now. But if you've decided that that's not working out so well, and you're suffering the consequences of your own choices, and you don't want to do that anymore, then there is a solution. God has anointed a king. He has set up a king. And that king is the only one who can rule you without ruining you. The only one. And if you have decided it's time for regime change, it's time to put somebody else in charge, then you can do that by rendering obedience to the gospel. You can, having believed in Jesus Christ, you can turn away from the things that you've been doing that are destroying you. Turn away from your sin. Repent of that. And you can acknowledge that Jesus is, in fact, Lord. He is King. He's the one that should be running things. And you can be baptized. You can put to death the old man of sin and be raised up to walk in newness of life. Share the hope that we have of an eternity with the God who loves us and has redeemed us. If we can help you to do that this morning, or maybe you're struggling, maybe you're not sure which way to turn. You're facing challenges in your life and you don't feel equal to those challenges. You need the help of the prayer of the saints here. Come now as we stand and as we sing.